You're listening to the Apple Insider Podcast.
Welcome to the Apple Insider Podcast. I'm Victor, and joining me is William Gallagher.
Hello.
The ever reliable, the ever happy William Gallagher.
Ah, that sounds nice. I'll take that. I was called unacceptable earlier today by a producer, but that's another story. Hi.
You should be happy.
It was a searing, dramatic comment about my searing political drama, so I was not in any way unhappy, but there you go. You just put it back into my head.
It sounds searing.
It was.
Yes. Well, I want to tell you, there's a lot of negativity available, right? There's negativity everywhere, from the rejection that you experienced, from the verbal abuse that I receive, sometimes for doing this podcast, sometimes for other things. There's tons of negativity around, and I want to remind you and of course our friends out there listening as well, that there are a lot of things to be positive about, and we're going to talk about some of them.
Oh, okay. I could do with that. Let's have some of that then. Yes.
Yeah.
What have you got?
Well, first of all, if you like the iPhone and you like Apple and you want to see them be profitable, then perhaps you can draw some pleasure from this. Apple is seeing double-digit iPhone sales growth in China.
Yes.
Now, this is meaningful because, of course, China is one of the most populous countries on the planet. And so double-digit sales percentages in China mean quite a large number of people.
Oh, that's a good point. Yes, it does.
Right?
I actually hesitated when you said this because whenever somebody posts a percentage growth, yeah. I'm suspicious until I see the figures. But you're right. Any percentage of China has got to be huge. Cool.
Right. Percentage of, you know, Tring, England, is not helpful to anyone, right? Unless, of course, you're a shop on the high street of Tring. But percentage of China is potentially meaningful, especially when we're talking double-digit growth. Now, yes, percentages, you know, double-digit growth just means you grew more than you did last year. But let's look at some actual numbers here, like you say. So, year-on-year, iPhone sales grew 18.7%.
Yes.
At the same time, the overall Chinese market for smartphones declined by 13.7%. So in a year of double-digit decline, the iPhone grew in double digits.
I'd still love to know actual numbers, but yes, okay. That is impressive. Particularly since this time last year, things were declining. So Apple's done well. I don't quite know how well yet, but still, well is good. There we go.
Yeah.
That's analysis for you. Well is good.
Well is good. But in a year of decline, especially, that is positive news. Now,
yes.
We don't have precise data, but what we do know is that there's the China Academy of Information and Communication Technology, which says that there were 389 million cell phone shipments in China during 2019.
It's an amazingly high number, isn't it? Okay. Hard to conceive when numbers are this big, but yes.
And that, you know, this is really quite good.
We should give credit here to Bloomberg, who've got those figures, but also they have some other unreported Android device shipment data, and they put it together to come up with this 18.7.
Yeah. So Bloomberg has reported this, and they're getting these figures from the China Academy.
Yes.
And now, some of those... That data seems to include about 13 million 5G-capable iPhones. Now, obviously, Apple doesn't sell one of those at this time. So Bloomberg works backwards through these numbers to arrive at this double-digit growth.
Hmm. I looked at the data, and it was very complicated. I was glad somebody with a better maths brain than I did worked it out. But I think that issue about 5G, I was surprised it was 13 million 5G. I mean, I don't know which handsets they were. But it's interesting that Apple's doing so well despite not having 5G when others clearly... do.
So 5G is early days, right? 5G requires that you have the capable handset, that you also have capable antennas from the carriers so that it can actually talk at 5G. And we're being a little bit oversimplified here because 5G means more than just, well, 5G. There are actually three different variants, and you use them in different locations depending upon the context with which you're installing the tower. You know, there's 5G that's best for dense urban areas. There's 5G that is more high speed for wider range open areas. So you have to use the appropriate one in its right application. So just 5G itself, first of all, not so many towers. Second of all, three different variants. There's a lot to go in there.
Hand on heart, I only think of two variants. I didn't realize it was three. It's even worse than I thought.
Yep, three.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I'm going to skip 5G. I'll just wait till 6G comes along.
Well, you know, what you could do is, if, first of all, we've talked about this in past and rumors, that the first iPhone 5G phone is probably going to be maybe this 2020 phone, and it'll come with a Qualcomm chipset. And we'll get a couple of years of that, perhaps, and then around 2023, maybe, we'll have one that's using Apple's own chipset, because Apple picked up the technology from Intel.
Yeah, I know that date is varying, because I remember the first guess was 2025, and then 2023, and then there are other things that it could be even sooner. But
right, yes, but the idea is that you could pick up a second year Qualcomm 5G, right, a 2021, 2022 phone, and be quite happy with it, because at that time there will be enough towers around and things will have been sorted out a little bit.
And that was what you mean, yes.
So you and I, we buy the very first of new everything, right?
Yes, as long as they're in blue, yes.
Yes. We got one of everything, please. Apple's product line, the whole deal, right away. And we do.
Plus spares.
Plus spares, absolutely.
Yeah.
And
house is full of Mac Pros at the moment. Don't know what to do with them. Yeah.
They're keeping you warm in this winter season.
Using two to balance a coffee table.
But the thing of it is that there are some advantages to waiting for the second year of technology.
That's true. Yes, good point.
It tends to be a little more refined. It tends to be a little bit wider distributed, and the supporting technology is also more widely distributed. And so, you know, this isn't to say that people shouldn't buy the first year of something. It's to say that there are advantages sometimes to buying the second year when it's got a chance to really find its legs. And, you know, I would tell you that you, William, personally could comfortably buy a second year 5G phone and then buy the one with Apple's chipset when it comes. Or even the second year of Apple's chipset when it comes, kind of thing. And that you'd be safer doing so, just in terms of having everything worked out.
Yes. Yes. Safer, yes. More comfortable. You're spending my money comfortably, but I agree on the safety part.
I'm doing very well at spending your money, and we should be optimistic and happy about that.
That's true.
It's a show about happiness.
I love my iPhone 11 Pro, but I want to buy another one of something else. It's 11, 12, whatever it's called, in September. You're right. And be happy about it, William. Okay.
Yeah. Mythic Quest, Raven's Banquet, is an Apple TV Plus exclusive show. It is Apple TV Plus's first comedy series. And Rob McElhenney talks about how it is to work with Apple. So he's the star, former star of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. And he's also producing this show. And he said that Apple's strategy is really similar to the way that FX handled things, and that it provides notes and pushback when it disagrees with aspects of the show. But in the end, the decision always falls to him and the showrunners.
I might be very, very stupid here, but I truly believed that Mythic Quest Raven's Banquet was a game. I did not realize.
Well, it sounds like it, doesn't it? But that's probably why it was so named.
Well, that makes sense. Okay. But I'm actually vastly more interested now, because I'm not particularly a gamer, but now suddenly, okay, I'm intrigued.
It's a show.
I've been hearing from other producers that are less keen on Apple TV Plus and how Apple's doing it, but he sounds like he's given a lot of details.
Yeah, so the show is a combination of humor, smart social commentary, characters, and a little bit of heart, too. And so it's that kind of show that makes it a good fit for Apple TV Plus. And, of course, obviously it has yet to debut, but he's talking really positively about how it is to get notes from Apple and work with Apple and just how respected he feels there.
Do we know when it's going to air?
February 7th.
Oh, right. Cool. So quite soon.
Yeah. And it's got a great cast, too. It's McElhenney and also Charlie Day, who also worked on It's Always Sunny. It's got F. Murray Abraham.
Okay, wow, all right.
You didn't expect me to pull that name out, did you?
I can't say I did. No, okay.
Salieri from Amadeus.
Yes, and millions of other things, but is the first one that comes to mind. That's such a performance, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Can you name a newer role that he might have had? Because, I mean, that's going back quite a ways.
I believe he's in Mythic Quest.
There you go.
Yeah, all right.
Danny Pudi, who is in Community.
Oh, good grief, yes. Okay, great.
Imani Akin.
Oh, I'm watching this now,
yeah.
Definitely.
Charlotte Nickdow, David Hornsby, Ashley Birch, and Jesse Ennis. So it the series dives into challenges of running a successful video game studio, which there's your video game tie-in.
Okay.
I know you don't care so much about the video game part of it, but of course, comedic and other elements like that should really draw you in.
Yeah, well, I love Sports Night, Aaron Sorkin's behind the scenes of a sports cable show, and I have zero interest in sports either. So yes, this will not put me off. I will be tuning in.
Did you ever watch Halt and Catch Fire?
I saw the first episode. I don't know how it was available in the UK, but one episode dropped somewhere, and I just thought it was really good. Did you see the whole
one? Yeah, no, I did, and it was not so comedic as this show intends to be, but it was almost documentary for me. You know, I
read the script as well. Read very well.
Yeah. Okay. Another show that I quite liked a lot.
Cool.
I think this Mythic Quest may be, it's going to be an easy one to sort of draw comparisons and contrasts with Silicon Valley, which is ending as a show.
I've not seen that one. I know of it, but if it airs here, I haven't caught it. Do you recommend it?
You've got all these things to look forward to. You can still watch them.
I'm still waiting for Little Voice to appear on Apple TV.
Mm.
But it will come.
It will. It will. Now, I'm going to talk about privacy in a moment here, but first I want to talk a little bit about ExpressVPN. We all know that a VPN protects your privacy and security online, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But this may solve actually all of your problems. One of the things that the VPN can do is it can help you take your TV watching game to the next level. Because you can use the VPN to unlock movies and shows that are region locked to other countries.
Yeah.
So you could use the ExpressVPN and you could watch Halt and Catch Fire and you could watch Silicon Valley.
Right. Oh, okay. That sounds, it sounds good to me and bad for the TV companies.
For years, we were unlocking DVDs and unlocking Blu-rays so that we could view region locked material. And they were still getting paid for the disc, but it was important to be able to see them in places where they had yet to release or wanted to time their releases. And, if you owned the disc, you ought to be able to view it. In the streaming age, it's a little different, and it's somewhat problematic. But if you're using a service that you're paying for, you ought to be able to view it in whatever country you're in.
Oh, no, I agree with that completely. If I'm an American Netflix subscriber, but I happen to be out of the States, why should I be unable to watch what I'm already paying for? Yes, that's true.
Yeah. So, anyway, it's entirely possible to use ExpressVPN to view shows that are region-locked to other countries, because ExpressVPN hides your IP address and lets you control where you want sites to think that you're located. So you can choose from over 100 different countries, and just think about all the Netflix libraries that you could go to. You know, you could use ExpressVPN to access Japanese Netflix and watch Spirited Away. But it's not just Netflix. It also works with any streaming service like Hulu, BBC iPlayer, YouTube, you name it. There are hundreds of VPNs out there, but the reason that I use ExpressVPN to watch shows is because it's ridiculously fast. There's no buffering or lag, and you can stream in HD and no problem. And it's compatible with all of your devices, phones, media consoles, smart TVs, more. So you watch what you want to on the go or on the big screen wherever you are. And if you visit our special link right now, expressvpn.com/appleinsider, you can get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free. So you support the show, you watch what you want, and you can protect yourself at expressvpn.com/appleinsider. What do you think of that, William?
Everybody wins.
It's a good day when everybody wins.
Well, except, hang on, VPN protects privacy. There's got to be people who are against your privacy, like criminals and people like that, who wouldn't be happy with it. So almost everybody wins.
And that's good. Yeah, I mean, I understand you and I appreciate your empathy for the criminals and privacy
violators.
Hey,
it's part of the economy. You know, these people have to live. I'm not serious about that. Do you know what I mean?
Send your recommendations for Android phones and Facebook advertisers that William should watch intently to William@appleinsider.com.
Well,
send him Ring doorbells. Send him Gosh, what else has been widely reputed for violating privacy this year?
Well, I'll tell you what, while you're doing this, let me point out that as a result of hearing you and I talking about Masterclass, a friend actually bought me a year's subscription as a Christmas present. Mark Knighton is a listener. He bought me of it. And I spent the whole of Christmas watching all of Jodie Foster's things. It's, so yes, send me things. That's very, very nice of people.
Fantastic. And I thank you. That was very generous. Thank you for doing that.
Gorgeous, yes. And Jodie Foster is every bit. I'd seen clips, but I've now watched about 3 hours of the thing, and I could listen to her forever.
Are you doing really the assignments? Useful. Doing the homework?
Yes, actually, I am. And I'm planning a short film for later this year where I will... it was specifically about directing as well as working with writers. I'll be putting into practice as best I can things she's said.
That's
yes.
Brilliant. You have to share what you've learned.
Okay. Well, I can give you a 3 hours, 40-odd minute version of it in her voice.
No. But just, it would be interesting to know what you took away from these kinds of things.
Good point. Okay. Trying to decide who to learn from next, but there we go.
There are so many to choose from.
77 or something, or even higher than that. Yes.
Yeah. But I want to talk about something that hasn't happened in forever. Apple has not appeared in an official capacity as a presenter in any way at CES in about, 20 years or more? 30 years? It's been a long time.
Hmm.
Jane Horvath is Apple's Senior Director of Global Privacy, and she took part in a privacy-centric panel at CES on Tuesday, where she talked about the company's initiatives to protect customer data and defended its stance on hardware encryption. And their
defended.
Belief, yeah, well, I mean, that's one of the things that's come under fire. So Apple has this belief.
You would have thought the CES audience would be well up for how Apple does this, because the CES audience, we would hope, would understand backdoor encryption and its other dangers, but still it was a hot-button issue.
Well, let me just tell you a little bit more about this, right? So please. Apple has a history. You know, the FBI requested that Apple create backdoors in the iPhone in 2016. And there was even some legislation floated. A bill was written that didn't go anywhere, basically requiring companies to create backdoors. And I think it was, I might get this wrong, but it was Richard Burr for certain, and maybe he was doing it alongside Dianne Feinstein. I can't remember. Not positive about that, but it was Richard Burr for sure who'd floated this legislation. It died quickly, but it was the idea that companies had to create backdoors to allow access. And Apple's argued against those because strong encryption is an effective method of ensuring that sensitive information stays private. And, you know, she said, our phones are relatively small and they get lost and stolen. If we're going to be able to rely on our health data and finance data on our devices, we need to make sure that if you misplace that device, you're not losing your sensitive data.
That's a good point.
Yeah. And furthermore, she answered it directly. Building backdoors into encryption is not the way we're going to solve these issues.
Did she offer a solution to these issues, an alternative?
Well, Apple complies and Apple offers assistance to law enforcement agencies. And they have a team specifically to handle such requests. But for the encryption mechanism is designed to keep personal information safe from prying eyes. Once the device is locked, data stored cannot be accessed without successful entry of a predetermined passcode or password. Now, Apple can, with a proper warrant, go into the data that's stored off-site, like iCloud, but they're unable to break into an iPhone without writing custom software. That's the backdoor. And the reason why this is important is because it wasn't just something that happened once in 2016 was over. On Monday, The FBI sent a letter to Apple again asking for the help in extraction of data from two iPhones. And they said no.
So the FBI is figuring third time's the charm.
I don't know. I think the FBI is hoping that as long as they can keep making this an issue, that the public will eventually side with the FBI. That has not happened. In 2016, the public sided with Apple on this. And, you know, it's one of those things where you keep asking until you get the answer you like.
I think Apple did do a very good job of putting their position across, because, I mean, gun attacks, deaths, these are really volatile topics, and it's very easy to get down the route of assuming anything that helps prevent them must therefore be good, whereas this thing of the bigger picture. I think also, wasn't there an issue at the time that there was some doubt that there was any information on the phones that would be used? But that's a separate thing. Still, Apple was standing up for the bigger picture, and generally in heated times, the bigger picture doesn't get seen.
So the common complaint of people who defend the FBI's position here is that there should be no evidence that the law enforcement cannot have. That if you've got a warrant, then that information needs to be available no matter what. And the counter to that is that, first of all, at least in America, the Constitution says that some information, that information is not available unless you have a proper warrant. And secondly, that, you can't be compelled to give up some information. That's part of the Fifth Amendment. You can't be compelled to testify against yourself. And I have to be very careful, because I can easily get into the bad legal takes domain, because I am not an attorney. But the other part of it is that, just empirically, there's always been some data and some evidence that's not been available to law enforcement. That's before the history of wiretapping. There were phone calls that weren't available. And even with wiretapping, you couldn't just listen in on everyone's conversation from a public telephone. You had to define it that you were going after a certain person who was using that phone, and when it wasn't that person, you couldn't listen. Right? So there are things that there are boundaries around what evidence can be available and what evidence is acceptable to go after. And it is because of that, there's no reason that we shouldn't say, look, some evidence is not going to be available. And the notion is that putting a backdoor in here violates that. Now, if it's stored off-site, it's not on the user's phone, then yeah, absolutely. And Apple does that. They participate in that. But if it's locked with a user's passcode, then the user has to be able to be the one to surrender that.
What's the situation with when people die? I mean, we've had cases where gunmen were killed and therefore couldn't even be talked into giving up their passcodes and things. Does the estate, descendants of these people have the right? How would they even know? Ignore me.
I don't know. I mean, you might be able to presume that they own the device through inheritance, but would they have the passcode, and could they be compelled to give it up? No knowing. No telling.
No. Plus, at least a couple of times in these incidents, people have shot their iPhones in order to prevent these things.
There's a number of different court cases where the decision is made both ways in the U.S., where a person can be compelled to give up their thumbprint in order to unlock a phone, or the person can't be compelled to give up their thumbprint. In the U.S., I think the way it's settled so far is that you can't be compelled to give up a password, but in the U.K., you can. So this is an area that's still developing.
Oh, I remember this coming up before, because I remember telling you I worked with a group of sort of 8 to 12-year-olds on a project, and one of them tapped me on the shoulder, and when I turned around, he had my iPhone in front of me, and so I instantly unlocked it just by looking at it. 8-year-olds should work for the FBI. No. Okay. It was a thought.
I mean, it doesn't really fit within the hiring requirements, but in some cases, they might be even more creative and
it's
useful.
It's 21 Jump Street all over again.
Okay. You're going to write, you're going to write a pint-sized FBI story, aren't you?
I wasn't, but it's crossing my mind now. I claim all rights. Okay. Pint-sized FBI. That's even a good title.
There you go. But that's not what our listeners came here to listen to.
No.
They came here to listen to optimistic, positive things. And of course, protecting privacy is positive, but that's a difficult topic. You know what's really going to make you happy?
I've no idea. Fire away.
Faster data.
Oh, yes. Yes. You've got me some faster data.
Isn't that an easy win? Faster data. Yes. Yes. So Intel has confirmed that Thunderbolt 4 is on the way.
Oh, okay. Right. Right.
It's going to be supported by upcoming processors in their product line, and that the connection throughput is going to be absurd. It's going to be four times the throughput of USB 3.
Right. Which is no slouch itself, really, to be fair.
No.
Okay.
I mean, USB 3.0 has a maximum theoretical speed of 5 gigabits per second.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, Thunderbolt 2 is capable of 20 gigabits per second, and Thunderbolt 3 is double that at 40 gigabits per second. So,
okay.
So saying 4 times 5 is 20, and that's what we could do that like two generations ago, is not really interesting. It's more probable, more likely, that Intel's referring to the USB 3.2 update, the Gen 2x2, which is capable of 20 gigs per second using two lanes. So if that's the case, if that's what Intel's talking about, then that puts Thunderbolt 4 as a throughput of around 80 gigabits per second.
Oh, that's just rubbish. Are they actually not being that clear about it? Is this a fairly vague Intel announcement then?
Well, I mean, saying 4 times USB 3 sounds really good. Saying 4 times USB 3.2 Gen 2x2 is a little rubbish as a marketing slogan.
Yeah, but 4 times USB 3 divided by 2, I'd have taken that one. Well, I'm more concerned, actually, I've got to say, I have these 45 Mac Pros dotted around the house. Are they now obsolete?
They run Thunderbolt 3.
Yeah, that old rubbish thing.
But listen, they're not obsolete until Intel ships this stuff. And Intel has not shipped it, they've announced it.
Okay, and Intel's very good at announcing things, isn't it?
Well, so we don't know a couple of things, right? We don't know when exactly this is going to be available. We expect specifications to be available ahead of the Tiger Lake processors, which are going to come sometime this year in 2020. But even then, it's not clear that Apple will adopt that as soon as it's available.
True.
You know, we don't know if Thunderbolt 4 is going to come before USB 4.
Okay.
Now, so I know you're shaking your head and saying, USB 4? What's USB 4? We just got USB 3 on all of our laptops. Right. USB 4 is 40 gigabits per second, power delivery of up to 100 watts, and backwards compatibility with earlier USB 3 standards, including Thunderbolt 3 connections. So it's USB 4 is going to use the same connector.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe. But it's going to be backwards compatible. So we expect that it would.
Okay. So you think maybe adapters as well?
I'm hopeful not, because it says USB 4 offers this 40 gigabits per second power delivery and backwards compatibility with earlier USB standards, including along with Thunderbolt 3 connections. So the signaling has to be the same and compatible. And, you know, that connector was just ratified, is just making its way onto laptops, really. And it's been there, since 2016? Shifting connectors again feels a little soon, don't you think?
Yeah, okay. So I won't throw out my 60 Mac Pros just yet.
Keep the blue ones. I mean, if you will, keep the blue
ones. Good point. Okay. All right.
Right.
And the two under the coffee table. That's only sensible. Yeah.
Well, yes. Now, we've talked a lot about iPhone SE 2.
Yes.
So,
are we going to talk about it more?
On
leaks. Is there something more?
Yeah, there is. So on leaks, correctly predicted the iPhone 11's triple camera system, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they have made some renders, they've issued some renders of a 360-degree video showing what they think the iPhone SE 2 looks like.
Okay. I thought we knew that. It's going to look
well,
very much like an iPhone 8.
We knew how to describe it. We hadn't really seen a render or a picture before now.
Okay.
And their render basically complies with what we already thought we knew.
So is that confirmation of what we already know, or is it utilizing what we already know to make a nice picture?
I'm not certain. I can't tell you that. But it basically, it has the screen and home button of an iPhone 8. It has a single camera on the back and a glass back so that it can do the wireless charging. It basically is a nice-looking little phone. But there's not a whole lot else to say about it.
Does a single camera mean it doesn't have the bump?
No, it has a bump.
Yeah. Okay.
We've had a camera bump since iPhone 6. The bump is not going away.
Oh, good point. I've forgotten about that on the 6.
And the bump is certainly not going away on the iPhone SE 2. You know, if you were going to lose the bump, you'd want to lose the bump on a flagship phone, like an iPhone 12 or something.
Yes. Okay. Get rid of the bump and the notch. Put it on. Yeah. Yes. This can all happen.
Well, no, fair point. This doesn't have a notch at all.
That's true.
Because it has a giant chin and a forehead like an iPhone 8.
That's amazing how old-fashioned that already sounds. And it's not that long ago since that was great.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Any more word on when this mythical iPhone SE 2 will come out?
First half of this year, 2020.
Okay. Right. So that's two iPhone launches in the year.
It is. Not the first time that's ever happened, by the way.
When was the last one? Do you remember?
One that sticks out in my... So there was the iPhone 5C that was a weird launch. And there was also the white 5S, or where they'd been struggling with making white phones for some time. And so white version came late.
Actually, didn't the iPhone SE come out on a different date to all the other iPhones? I've got this feeling I'm hearing on its own, but I can't.
I think it did not. I think it came out at a regular October announcement.
All right.
I think.
Well, we'll take new iPhones whenever they offer them.
Yeah, exactly. Now, okay. And also talking about taking things, Samsung.
Yes. Yes.
They took something, didn't they? What'd they take?
No, they crack Samsung designers independently ended up with an icon that purely by chance is...
Has a passing resemblance.
It's like pixel perfect resemblance to Apple's Face ID icon. Yes. Yes.
It does look familiar, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, these things happen, you know. It's not like you can think that Samsung actually was aware of the Face ID icon. How could that happen? They all have Samsung phones. Of course they do.
Okay. So we're looking at this. This was an image that Samsung put up in their keynote, right? And it's got an eye, and it's got this facial recognition icon that we're talking about. It's got a heart with a sort of pulse EKG line drawn through it. It's got a fingerprint icon, a running man, and a map.
Yes.
With a location pointer, location pin. And of those things, the map with the location pin is a pretty common icon. We've seen it pop up in iOS apps for years. The running man feels like a fairly normal icon.
It actually looks to me like the walk, don't walk sign in Paris.
Right. It does look like a traffic pedestrian crossing sign. The Touch ID logo we tracked down to a clip art site kind of thing. Where did I find that?
In a hurry with this Samsung, do you think?
How's that?
Got a clip art company, borrowed Apple's thing. It's not like they may have taken a very long time to do these icons.
Yeah, so this icon for the Thumb Touch ID version was Fingerprint SVG Human from Clipart Wiki.
All right.
Yep.
Love that.
Okay. Yeah, what a great name, too. And then the heart icon, fair enough. But this facial recognition icon looks precisely like the one that's on your iPhone. And the face... especially with the J nose, look, and the long marks for eyes, looks exactly like the face that was used on the original Mac in 1984.
Yes. So there you go. From 84 to 2020, I don't think that's reasonable prior art at all. Samsung's got a case here that Apple somehow copied them. That's what I'm thinking.
So you're saying that Apple has a time machine?
Well, you know, there are so many rumors. Apple does and doesn't do. I wouldn't be surprised. A car, a time machine. That's probably what Johnny Ive's working on now. Yeah.
So it'll be white.
I would think so.
Or space gray.
And made out of aluminum. No.
Aluminium, if you will.
That's it. Sorry, my way is aluminium. Your way is aluminium. Okay.
I love it. So, right. The point of icons is obviously to convey information quickly.
Sure.
And you immediately look at that and you know what it's for.
That's true. That is true.
Although, the question is, do you look at that and know what it's for based on its prior implementation in iPhone? Because just looking at a face inside of a, four like angle brackets doesn't necessarily communicate that well.
No, we've learned what it is through Apple. Samsung's just, it's an acknowledgement of how well done Apple's work in this field.
Look, icon design is hard, and that's why Susan Kari drew these icons. You know, they hired her to draw these icons because icon design is hard. And they hired, and she was hired again by Microsoft when Microsoft did Windows 3. 3.0, 3.1, 3.11.
Legend.
She did all the icons for that as well. It is, there are reasons why people pay her to do this, and it's because she designs icons that communicate. And you only hope that Samsung is paying her too. Although technically, I think Apple owns this property and they'd have to pay Apple.
Apple has registered that as a trademark, the drawing of this. So, yes. Yes. Even now, Samsung lawyers might be going, "Duh."
Cringe.
Or not. Yes.
Okay. So, positive news for everyone except maybe not Samsung lawyers.
Yes. Positive news for Apple lawyers. Let's assume that.
They'll just
let it go.
Positive. I mean, it's way more positive than the experience Tim Cook had at the Golden Globes.
That is true. Yes. Okay.
That's a reference to your countryman, Ricky Gervais, and his opening speech where he talked about how everyone was jumping on a streaming service and everyone was using Apple. And, of course, Apple is he had critical comments about Apple's production methods and called them sweatshops.
Yeah, I mean, he made a good – I found it actually weirdly written diatribe because it kind of changed gears. It sounded like it was all about Apple, but actually – it was how bad all the Hollywood stars are for working for companies that allegedly have these things.
His initial part of that was that Hollywood stars should not use their award speeches to make political positions of any case.
He said that after the Apple sweatshop allegation, but yes.
But it was part of that segment.
It was clear what it was about, but it was quite peculiarly written, but got some interesting reactions from Hollywood.
But I think it was Jennifer Aniston who accepted the award on behalf of
it's not the morning show, unfortunately, but
but she accepted the award on behalf of an Australian star whose name escapes me and now I'm embarrassed because he's in Australia as Australia's on fire.
Good point.
Interesting. A lot of the streaming services didn't really have a good showing in terms of actual awards. There were some good nominations, but in terms of receiving awards, Netflix, Amazon, and Apple didn't really receive so many, did they?
The Golden Globes was screened in the States, weren't they? They weren't here, as far as I know. So I've only seen little bits of the coverage. Obviously, Ricky Gervais' thing went viral for it. But other than that, I wasn't terribly aware of what did or didn't win in the end. So not only Apple was shut out of the game.
It was Russell Crowe. It was so Russell Crowe's speech about Australia that Jennifer Aniston read.
Yes.
Sorry.
Okay.
But yeah, so anyway, that's our show. I can't think of anything else I'd like to talk about except to wish you great vibes, positive feelings, and really optimism for the week ahead.
You mean we've run out of happy things?
No, I think there's no shortage, but I think we've run out of happy, interesting Apple-related things.
Oh, fair enough. Okay, I'll take that. Good. Okay.
We'll have more next week.
Okay, promise?
I absolutely promise. I will find something positive and happy to say about Apple News next week. Until I do, where can we find you, William?
I'm on Twitter as W Gallagher and email as william@appleinsider.com. What about yourself?
I'm V Marks on Twitter and victor@appleinsider.com. And thank you guys so much for listening. I have enjoyed our time together and I hope you have too. We'll be back next week.